Welcome to the Voodoo Power Podcast.
Welcome to Plates and Pancakes. We're sitting down today with Tony Holler. Coach Holler has been in the business of speed for well over 40 years. The son of a coach and a track athlete himself, he moved into the field as a chemistry teacher and a high school track coach. He has revolutionized the sprinting world with his Feed the Cat system, realizing that in most cases, athletes hated track. They were moving to other sports because something needed to change. Coach Holler is a member of the Illinois Track and Field Hall of Fame, and he has amassed a cult-like following and a system that gains converts daily. So welcome to the show, Coach.
Well, thank you, Stephen. That was a nice introduction.
Well, I hope so. I think it's fitting for everything you've done. So kind of to kick the show off, one thing I've found about you as I've researched you is you are very generous with your time and your content. You give a lot of stuff away. So obviously, your desire to help athletes and help coaches is very important to you. When did you notice that a change needed to be made in athletics and track specifically?
Yeah, I was 40. I was born in 1959. In 1999, I call it my epiphany, you know, in storytelling. I just read a book called The Science of Storytelling, and they call it the ignition point of a story. And at that time, I'd been around for 40 years. My dad was a coach. I went everywhere with him. I have two uncles that were not only head football coaches, but career head football coaches, Hall of Fame coaches, that type of thing. And they were both my mom's brothers. So my family was just thick in it. And so, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, everybody wanted to be Lombardi. You know, I mean, that's who we were. We were tough guys. You know, mm-hmm. We were autocrats. We were guys that, you know, if a player talked back to you, he would regret it. You know, like that type of you know, and things have changed. And in 1999, my son, who was a terrific athlete, could dunk a basketball in the eighth grade, said, "Dad, I think I'm going to play baseball in high school. I don't want to run track. Track sucks." And I said, "It does, but," and that was kind of my epiphany. You know, it's like, it does, but it shouldn't. and so I just looked myself in the mirror and said, you know, it's going to be non-negotiable. It may not happen overnight, but I'm eventually going to get to the point where kids say that track practice is the best part of a kid's day, of their day. And so everything I've done since then is to try to make track unsuck. And of course, I was a football coach too. And so that was my goal there. And you know, I was a basketball coach in my early years, but not once I ever get to coach basketball as a Feed the Cats basketball coach. And I wish I would have, but you know, as a Feed the Cats chemistry teacher, you know, I told my kids on the first day of chemistry, this is going to be your favorite class in high school. And that's a tough statement to make, especially about chemistry.
You're right.
I mean, most people are like, "Oh my God, chemistry was the worst." But when I said that to kids on day one, they leaned into me. They kind of like, "I kind of like this guy, you know, like, God, do you think it really is going to be a good class?" And then I had to spend my entire year trying to live up to it. And if I didn't live up to it, I had to apologize. Like, "Hey, this week's going to suck, you know, because we have to do electron configurations. And I swear we'll blow something up on Friday or something, but we have to get through this material." And I just think they appreciated it. They knew that I cared about them. And it really became kind of a kid-centered thing. And what I found out was that kids started performing better because of my new way of looking at things.
And that actually, you led right into my next question, because me and you had emailed back and forth a little bit about this. And I mean, you come from a family of educators. You and your wife both are educators. You, between the two of you, you have over 70 years experience. How do you carry that system into the classroom? What does that look like?
Well, you know, there's a couple fundamental things about Feed the Cats. One is it's performance-based. We don't care about tradition. That we are out to win. We're out to win the game. Winning is more important than tradition. And And performance is much more important than hard work. And for so long in our country, it was, or I guess in life in general, is that we got to really make things hard on kids because life was hard. And that was kind of the fundamental thing through school and through sports. I mean, baseball teams, that really baseball is not a hard sport, but you know, they would run baseball players and until they hated it. And so basically in the classroom, all I cared about was performance. I didn't care about teaching bell to bell like teachers are taught. I didn't care about everything they've taught teachers forever, that you got to keep kids busy. If they're not busy, they're going to give you trouble. Well, if you keep them busy for 55 minutes, that's called busy work. That's not performance. That's activity. That's not achievement. You know, John Wooden said, never mistake activity for achievement. Or is it that word? Never mistake achievement for activity. Maybe it goes both ways. But we are not just going to be doing meaningless stuff. So we may not start my class for 5 minutes. We may be talking about something that happened yesterday. We may quit my class with 10 minutes to go and talk about something else. Other times, we're just full of really important stuff, maybe, that we just have to get in that day. But it was a way that we wanted to make school fun. Not fun in a joking, grab-ass type of way, but we wanted people to look forward to our class. When I talk about our class, my wife's class, my class, she taught second grade. And I think that all these people that talk about how soft kids are today, you know, they're almost hateful about kids. And it just makes me want to punch these people, because the kids I'm around are not awful. They are really good at what they like, and they're obsessed with what they love. So what we have to do, instead of feeding them stuff they don't like to eat, we need to find things they like or make the things they need more likable. And so I did that in chemistry, and I did that in track practice, and I still am. And that's why you say, you know, I've been very giving of my time. I am, because I'm not a religious guy, but you know, I kind of approach my stuff kind of like an evangelist preacher, you know, and when I talk, it's kind of like a tent revival, because I want to change people's lives. And you know, kids only get one chance to go through things. And if we're just making it awful for them, and they hate school, and they hate their practice, and they don't like their teachers and their coaches, I don't think they're going to perform for us. And so it really does get important, to me at least, that we change the thing. Instead of my way or the highway, it's like, let's go get this done. Let's get this done. And let's win in the classroom too.
No, you found a way to meet the kids where they're at and give them something that they could use, but also something they really enjoyed. And that's not as easy as what a person might think. So I want to go, I really want to talk sprinting, but you have so much sprinting information out there. I'd like to go a different angle for a little while. So I have the gym here. I deal with some kids that come in. And I deal with some other kids. I talk to people wherever I'm at. And that was the consensus I got from kids. They ran track to be better at football or another sport. And what they found happened was they come out of track slower and injured. So it hurt their other sport. It didn't do what they wanted them to do. In that, I started researching some stuff, and I found Louis Simmons's book on running. Now, while you guys may not agree on the weights, I think your running is, and plyometrics is very close. So I was on a vacation in Florida. I was researching the book in the mornings and the afternoons when everybody was kind of asleep, kind of trying to develop a system. And it dawned on me, hey, how could you do this for wrestlers? Wrestlers are notorious grinders. And at 27 years old, they look like old men. They're beat up, they're sore, they're hurt. How could you take your feed the cats approach and put it in a wrestling room?
You know, I've had, I would say, between 10 and 20 you know, really strong inquiries about how do we do a feed the cats wrestling. And for a long time, I was kind of like, because I have no wrestling background, it's kind of like, this is out of my league. I can't do this. But especially in the last 2 years, when I've started consulting with NCAA Division I lacrosse programs, I mean, like literally places that are, you know, win national championships and they're in the Final Four, and Princeton now feeds the Tigers. And so it's kind of like, even though I can't play lacrosse, I've never held a stick. I've never played in a game. I've never watched a full lacrosse game. I can be of help to a sport that I'm foreign to. So now that you ask that, I may answer it for the first time ever. And so this is going to be, you're making me think. And so, okay, performance is the key. We care about performance more than hard work. That changes everything right away. That if the hard work you're doing is hurting your performance, then you must do something different. If your athletes are so tired that they are miserable, and you know what I'm talking about, mm-hmm. people that cut weight, you know, what was the movie about wrestling, Vision Quest?
Yes.
True Vision Quest is when Indians would go up into the mountains and nearly die from not eating food. And that's what wrestlers have done for decades. And I would like to think that even though I'm not a wrestler, that a Vision Quest is not a performance enhancer. If you're not eating and you're dehydrated to make weight and you're spitting and wearing trash sacks to sweat more. And a lot of those things have been addressed in the last 10, 15 years, but it's still a sport that I see people. It's kind of like, how hard can we work these guys every single day? And so I believe in everything we do that there is the Pareto principle. You know, the 20% of our work produces 80% of our results. And somebody asked me one time, is that scientific? And I went, no, it's just kind of an idea. But it's a damn good idea. And basically what it's saying is that you need to look at what is truly making your kids great wrestlers. I would think it's speed and power. Now, it's not sprint speed, because you're not sprinting in wrestling. However, sprinting, the faster you can sprint, the better the central nervous system becomes. And maybe you are quicker. Maybe you are more explosive. You can express your strength faster. So if that quality is important, let's do things that really improve that quality. And one of the things that really improves that is your amount of rest, recovery, and sleep. And most wrestling programs don't talk a whole lot about rest, recovery, and sleep, and they should. It is the foundation of all performance. I mean, you and your job, a school kid, you know, going to school, if they're not sleeping well, they're not going to perform well the next day. So I think it's really important that we look at the things that are the most important. As a basketball coach, I used to visit Bob Knight back in the 80s. And he was such a spectacular teacher and coach back then. It's before he turned kind of weird, kind of mean. But Bob Knight told me one time, he said, Tony, you got to look at everything you do and say, is this helping me win games? And I'll never forget it. You know, like, is this helping me win games? And I thought about some of the drills we did that looked kind of interesting. It made me kind of look like a good coach or something, and say, that's not doing a damn thing to win games. Mm-hmm. And so in basketball, you know, what wins games? Well, let's start with shooting. Number two, let's start with preventing the other team from scoring. Let's go to number three, the ability to move the ball without turning it over, and then start really focusing on those essentials. I love the book Essentialism, where it says, let's do less, but achieve more. Let's expand that 20% that Pareto talked about, creating the 80% of our results. And if you are in that tradition tribe, and it is a tribe, it makes us feel secure. If you're in that thing where you just say, trust the process, this is the way we do it, this is the way it's, my coach used to do it, this is the way other coaches do it, then you're never looking at things and saying, that needs to go, and that needs to go, and that needs to go. And when you say those things, you don't have to replace them. Because you don't, as a coach, you don't have to practice 2.5 hours. You could, you know, we had a 45-minute practice tonight. That's all we went, 45. And tomorrow, if it takes 60, we'll go 60 or 75 minutes. So we are not going to fill. We are going to focus on the things that really matter to performance. And like you said previously, it's easier said than done. And you have to talk to other people who are thinking like that. I call them rebel talents. You need to find rebel talents out there that are willing to just not repeat the same crap year after year after year, but instead they're out reading crazy stuff like Feed the Cats propaganda and saying, man, what really does matter in wrestling? And even though I can't really tell you all the things that matter in wrestling, I bet somebody that was a great wrestling coach could tell me that. And then we could sit down with that guy and say, let's look at your practice and see if you're accomplishing the improvement of those things. He may find out that he's doing a lot of stuff that may be counteracting the stuff that he wants done. So I don't know if that's a real satisfying answer, but I think we're going in the right direction to creating. Oh, and then one last thing. Somehow wrestling coaches really sell wrestling to their athletes. I mean, it looks miserable to me. It looks like something I wouldn't do in a million years. But the people who wrestle are proud of it. And they, in a way, they love it. And so I think that sometimes that interferes with a coach's evaluation process. Like, hey, my guys love it, so we're doing everything right. I don't think we can be very comfortable with that. I think that we have to ask ourselves, running those 100 laps, did that make my guys better wrestlers? And if it didn't, then we need to really think hard about what we're doing.
So you're very much a minimalist. You want to look at a program and just start getting rid of cutting the fat wherever you can.
For sure. The book Essentialism by McKeon is just, it didn't change my life like it did a lot of people, but it reaffirmed my life. You know, I say that, you know, I love when he says that if it's not a hell yes, you shouldn't say yes. You know, like we need to live our life with a hell yes attitude. And we really need to cut the fat. You know, kids are overextended these days.
I agree.
So many coaches don't have high school kids yet. They're not, because coaches, you know, coach 8 years now and get out of it. And so they never really see sports through a kid's eye. And I mean, I had four kids and that they would go to practice and sometimes, you know, 3.5 hours and come home miserable. Now they still look forward to the games. And I'm sure if the head coach say, do you love this? They say, oh, I love it, coach. Because that's what they're taught. We're always taught to say we love the sport. And, oh, we love the hard work. And it's making me a man and blah, 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 blah. But I think that we need to do better for kids.
Yeah, I agree with that 100%. Now, I did hear you talking in one of your videos the other day, and I thought it was a great way to look at something. And I'd never really thought about it. I talked about it, but I guess I hadn't thought about it on the level that you were expressing. So in the summer, when we're getting kids ready, kids are in the gym in and out all the time, you know, if they're not putting back into the weight room what you're putting into them, it's a drain on you personally as somebody that's trying to help. And you talking about your program, you found a way to keep the kids engaged and they actually carry the program and you can leave and you're not near as drained. Is that kind of what you were getting at? Or I don't want to put words in your mouth, but how were you able to do that? Just by minimalizing it? Or was there more that went into that?
For a long, long time now, I've said, I think even before I was a Feed the Cats coach, said that the great teams inspire their coach. They don't wait for the coach to inspire them. And I think that to be true. I don't care if it's professional, college, whatever, that great teams inspire their coach. But I will say this, that if you create a program where your practice is the best part of a kid's day, your kids will show up with enthusiasm. Enthusiastic kids do not have to be pushed. They don't have to be chewed out. They don't have to be belittled for a lack of effort. I can't remember the last time I told a kid, you didn't give me a good effort on that. Because my kids just come and, of course, they don't have to do a whole lot. You know, so because we do so little, and because I tell kids that every team in America works harder than we do, that is kind of a message to them that, well, gee, if we're not going to do all that everybody else is doing, we have to do it better than they do. And I'm like, yeah. And this is not, you know, this is not new. Steve Jobs said that if you truly love something, you don't have to be pushed. The vision pulls you. And I just feel that way, that if kids feel that vision pulling them, then they don't have to be pushed. And the great thing about a coach is that they get to leave practice with a bounce. They're inspired. They can't wait to go home and become a better coach that night and then show their kids an even better, even more fertile ground to grow. And this, I call it my endless feedback loop, that if they inspire me, I become inspired to be a better coach. And then I become a better coach and they get more inspired and it just win. And it just is so exciting. But just picture that coach that had to chew kids out and yell at them and be mean and push. And like, oh, okay, we're do conditioning right now. You know, we'll do conditioning for an hour if you guys don't get. They don't go home very nice. I don't think they have a great night with their wife and little kids. I think they go home mean, miserable. And then they drink too much at night. And then they wake up with a hangover and they have to go do it again. And that's why coaches don't coach as long as me. I'm in my 42nd year, and I'm almost overly excited right now about my track team. We're not going to be state champions, but I am so inspired by my kids. And I'm younger now at the age of 63 than I was when I was an old school coach at 23. That's hard to imagine. I don't look young, but I feel younger. I have more energy. All that comes from just changing the way things are done.
You could be 23, but if you're just training yourself every day, kids are a lot of fun. If you can find a way to have them be fun, well, then they can invigorate you. And even at an older age, you feel younger.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, it's an epidemic now of burnout.
Yes.
With coaches. I mean, and here's another Feed the Cats thing. This is one of my favorite stories. There's a football coach in Southern Illinois, St. Louis area, who installed a Feed the Cats. He says, I was the most old school jerk ever. I was a meathead, Neanderthal, blah, blah, blah. But he went to Feed the Cats. And he actually got a letter from the wife of one of his assistant coaches saying that Feed the Cats saved their marriage. Because practices weren't 3 hours anymore. They're 2 hours or 90 minutes. They no longer had 5-hour meetings on Sundays with the coaches. They no longer had to show up the morning after a game Saturday morning, 7 a.m., and run the kids. That kind of happens in some places. But instead, they let the kids sleep in on Saturday, let them sleep in on Sunday. They come back Monday, chomping at the bit, can't wait to have a great week of practice. And so all these things, you know, gave this lady's husband more time at home. He came home happier, more inspired. He had better weekends, and it saved their marriage. And so, you know, this stuff is important. I mean, like, kids need good coaches. They don't need burned out people that leave the profession when they're 35, you know, and then replace with some knothead 22-year-old that thinks they're Lombardi. You know, we need to do better for our kids than that.
But listening to you talk, yeah, this is so much bigger than just sports. I mean, this is a philosophy that's carrying over to people's at-home lives. Yeah, you can really change a lot of stuff with the philosophy. If it's just fluff, get rid of it. You don't need it. You could do something else.
Yeah, I've seen things, you know, like, you know how on Twitter now they're all these people are doing, you know, like, they're like, I don't know, they life coaches and things like that. And, you know, there's a thing that the Bloom puts out. It says that work like a lion, sprint and rest, sprint and rest. It's kind of like that thing about if it's not a hell yes, don't say yes. You know, I read a book called Groundedness by a guy named Brad Stolberg. It's fabulous, just fabulous. And he talked about writing, you know, and he said, quit when you're on fire, when you're writing really good. And when you do that, you're excited about picking it back up tomorrow. And not only are you excited, but you're in a good spot. You're on a roll that you pulled the plug on the day before. And I think you could look at sports the same way. Like if you let kids go home with some gas left in their tank, I think they're more excited about the next day. And maybe they pick up at a high point the next day. But that's, as you know, that's not tradition in sports in America. It's kind of like, we're going to run all the gasoline out of you, and then we're going to teach you how to play on fumes. And you will be really tired, but life's hard and practice is hard. And we're going to practice really hard so that the games are easy. It's one of the things my dad used to say, we're going to practice so hard that the games are easy. And even though my dad was a great coach, I've totally flipped it. I say, let the games be the hardest thing you do. In practice, let's really play at a high level. Let's practice at a high level. Let's go home before we are spent so that we can pick up the next day. So that when we go to sleep at night, this is a funny thing. I remember this just popped in my head. In the spring in Missouri, Illinois, you know, weather is not all that great. But, you know, like once in a while, there's a blue sky day. No wind, 70 degrees, and the birds are chirping. You look out and you see butterflies. And I used to think to myself, if it wasn't for track practice, this would be a really good day. I don't think you can be real good in track if practice is the dark cloud of your day. Yeah. But that's traditional and accepted. And I refuse. That's a non-negotiable for me now. If that's the way I had to coach, I'd just sit home and read. You know, I'm not going to coach anymore.
Now, the one thing you were talking about there, is the competitiveness you get. Now, do you find, I've heard you talk before on how much you track. Everybody knows what their numbers are. They know what the PRs are. They're competing every day. Do you think that is what brought your level of competitiveness up, as kids are competing every day?
I think so. It's, you know, it's really strange. Our human DNA, two of our strongest things, and this comes from, you know, picture 40,000 years ago, you know, like caveman, you know, primitive man, Indians. The two things that we really need, and this is not just, these aren't just wants, this is like baked into us. We need to be a part of a group, a tribe, and we want higher status. It's weird, like those things can work against each other, right? Mm-hmm. You know, like, but as coaches, we need to figure out a way to use those two things. And I think it's obvious we offer a kid a chance to be on a team, to belong. You know, just think about, you know, the people who, you know, like the kids that join a gang. Why do you think they join a gang? They need to belong. They didn't have the family that maybe other kids have. And so they needed to belong. And so they join a gang. It's a lot better to join a track team or a wrestling team, a lot safer. But once you join that team, you have to understand that the other thing they need besides just being on the team is to compete, because it's in us. Now, what you want to do is say, we as a team, as a group, are going to go out and beat this other group. I mean, that's why we go to war, by the way. You know, we join the team, America, and then we go to war to, you know, to beat Germany or Japan or whoever we're fighting wars against. But it's the same thing in sports. But here's the deal, too. It's not just our team against theirs. There is a competition for status that's built into us inside of our own team. Now that can blow up a team. If we have guys, you know, being overly competitive against other people on our own team. So what we do is we celebrate it. So everything that we can measure that matters, we measure. So a kid is competing for status against his former self. Maybe what he ran last year or what he ran last month. So he's competing with his own, you know, like self-competition. If he hears somebody just ran 22 miles an hour and his best time is 21.8 miles an hour, he's going to compete for status. He's going to want to run 22 miles an hour. And then you teach them through culture and just through that the most important thing is the love that we have for each other and belonging to this team. But the second most important thing is that competition. So when I frame the quote, it's not copyright or anything, but it's mine, record, rank, and publish. Mm-hmm. We're going to write down measurements of things that matter. We're going to rank them among the team. And then we're going to put it out on Twitter or pin it to a bulletin board or however you want to publish it, you're going to publish it. And what that does is makes those numbers meaningful. Now you got to be careful, because if, like in education, when they think that a chemistry test matters, it really doesn't. There's no way that anybody can measure learning chemistry through a test. Then you run into problems. You have to have a meaningful test before you record, rank, and publish it. But I would argue that, man, run, seeing how fast you run, that's a pretty meaningful test.
Yeah, definitely. Or, so,
or how high you jump, or how many pull-ups you can do, or how many push-ups you can do. I mean, all those things are pretty meaningful. So why not record them and get guys competing while they're in this group? You know, and if you can do those two things, it's a pretty good formula for winning.
And if kids are competing and having fun, as your lower guys get better, it's got to make your upper guys better, because now they have to be faster or they're going to get beat.
For sure. And you know, I tell kids every day, I told them today, you know, I said, hey, we have team t-shirts, and, you know, our first 3 weeks of track is tryouts. And I said, I think I'm going to hand out t-shirts to our top 10 guys at the end of next week. You know, we have like 35 guys in our sprint group. And I saw him kind of looking around right away, like, gosh, who's the top 10? But I want that, because we're competing every day. We're competing for times. You know, I told him today, I said, you know, only about 35 guys are going to get on the bus for our first big indoor meet. And we have 100 kids on the team. So who's going to get on the bus? Now, we all love each other and stuff. We are a team. But we are constantly working for status. And if you think about going back to the classroom stuff, competition is you're not supposed to compete anymore in the classroom. And I don't know if kids feel like they belong as much as they should. So we're kind of like ignoring those two really important things. You know, we're ignoring the fact that we need kids to feel like they belong. And then we need to encourage that competing for status. And if we don't, I don't know if we're performing. And, but I don't know if we could ever change education, because it's just, you know, it's kind of gone the other way. You know, we'll probably do away with grades.
Yeah. That way they're not, do everything in your power not to compete.
Right. Right. People have asked me, you know, like, do you think record, rank, and publish would work in the classroom? And I said, hell yeah, I did it. I did it in the 80s and nobody ever called me on it. You know, I would list the top 15 scores on a test and call it the Hall of Fame. And on the other side is the Hall of Shame. I'm surprised I didn't get fired, but the bottom 15 scores. Now, if a teacher did that these days, they would not work tomorrow. But it kind of shows us the difference between a performance-based sport and a non-performance-based classroom. I would argue that performance in the classroom just as important as sport, but yet we have kind of grown soft, you know, in the way that we educate kids. And I don't want my athletes to be soft. I want them to love the competition, love their team, but compete like hell throughout. And I think kids are good with that. I don't think they go home crying because somebody beat them, because they're used to it. That's what we do.
Yeah. They just find a way to get better.
Yeah. Or do the best they can do.
Yes. Yeah. They compete with themselves and they be a better sprinter or whatever the case may be.
For sure. The last thing they're going to do is, no, coach, don't tell me my time. No, they want to know their time. Whereas in the classroom, sometimes kids will be, I don't know. I don't want to know my score on that test. No, you should. You should want to know. And it should piss you off if you didn't do very good. And do better the next time. That's what we do.
Yeah. Just every day's a process to get better.
Yep.
Now, way back in the conversation there a little bit ago, you were talking about jumping. I know in the research I've done and the videos I've watched of you, that plays a huge part in sprinters. I've read that, you know, from very reliable sources, that the higher your box jump is, the faster you're going to be. There's no two ways about it. It has to carry over. It's the only element of exercise that actually really does carry directly over to the track. Now, I could be wrong on that, and if I am, that's fine. We'll talk about that. But how much emphasis do you put on your plyometrics and your jumping?
A lot. I upset weight room people often. And if we talk long enough, you know, they won't punch me, you know, but you know, I say there's nothing in the weight room that directly improves speed. Mm-hmm. I think strength is good. I think we need to be general in the weight room. Let's get strong. There's no such thing as sport specific lifts or speed specific lifts. And they always want to argue that they really want to believe that everything good in athleticism comes from their weight room. And I understand that, especially, you know, people who have invested in a weight room. And they think that I'm like, you know, like putting them down or something. I'm not. So they'll argue that cleans, like if you move the bar fast, that improves speed. And what I say is that's conjecture. Maybe sometimes that is true, but here's the deal. There's nothing in the weight room that a fast guy does well and a slow guy does poorly. I've seen slow guys who could clean really well, and that's good. You know, strength is good. Explosive lifting is good. Moving the bar fast is good. So if there's nothing directly in the weight room that improves speed, is there other exercises? And I call my exercises my X factor stuff. And the most important thing is the ability to jump and react to the ground. It's not just how high you can jump, even though that's overall, if I see a 5'10 kid dunk a basketball with two hands, I'm offering him a contract for a track. I mean, like what do I have to do to get you out for my track team? Because I know he's fast without ever watching him sprint. the ability to jump really high and explosively is a great direct thing between, you know, between jumping high and speed. But if he can jump high and bounce off the ground and jump high again, that's even more so. That's one of my favorite things. The ability to react off the ground. I just call it bounce. Mm-hmm. You know, the five things, my five things, and my five things are mine. Snappiness, that's the ability to quickly go from your leg behind you to in front. You know, trail leg to front side leg. And that snappiness is elasticity. I like the word snappy, though. So sprinters are snappy, so we try to do exercises that look snappy. Bounce is another one. That's the ability to hit and get back off the ground. When I think of bounce, I think of Dennis Rodman, who looked like he was on a pogo stick. He could go up for a rebound, tap it, and get right back off the ground in like a nanosecond and tap it again. You know, that bounce, I think, is really, really important to a sprinter. Power, explosiveness, and that's really important. And people say, oh, that's the weight room. Yes, it is. Yeah, that power is in the weight room, so that's good. But there's also other ways that you can train power. And I think you train power with plyometrics. So that's really important. And then I call it big split. That's the ability to, for your thighs to split apart. You know, all good runners get great big in the front, and they get an angle between the two femurs of, you know, like about 100 degrees, 105 degrees. So they're able to do a big split in the thighs. And then the last thing is central nervous system, just creating sprint habits. But getting back to, you know, the things we do in exercises, all five of those things we try to get done when we are not sprinting. For example, today we did long lunges where we see how long we can lunge. And then we pick up that back foot like a runner would and step into another long lunge. You say, well, what's that doing? That's big split work. And you say, well, is there some power element there too? Yeah, I think that when you come up out of a lunge, you're recruiting a lot of muscle fibers. I mean, I think there's some power stuff going on mm-hmm. there. Is there bounce? No, there's no bounce. Not in that one. But maybe the next thing we'll do, there'll be a bounce element in it. So we're always looking for new exercises. And, you know, we throw med balls. Why do we throw med balls? That's power. We throw med balls for power. So we can do power things outside the weight room or in the weight room.
Yeah. So talking about the bounciness. So are you trying to shorten the amortization phase on your double jump? So do you do things that would be a double jump, like maybe a broad jump to a box jump or combined jumps to shorten that period between the one jump to the second jump?
Define amortization for me.
The ability or the time it takes to finish one jump and start the next jump.
Okay. So that's kind of like time on the ground.
Yes. Yes.
Kind of?
Yeah, okay. I would agree with that.
Okay. So I don't think I've ever used that word. Amortization is kind of like, correct me if I'm wrong here, kind of like what I'm talking about, reacting to the ground. Mm-hmm. So if somebody can react quickly to the ground, he has a short amortization.
Yeah. Yeah. So on the second jump, so I'm sure maybe some of your faster kids on that second jump are way quicker than maybe other kids that need a pause to gather themselves.
For sure. So the answer is absolutely. And that's where, yeah, that all goes under my word. That's a much simpler word, just bounce. They're able to bounce into another jump. Like tonight we did a TBJ, triple broad jump. And mm-hmm. my best guy can do 31 feet from two foot start, gets his hands way back. And the amount of time on the ground in that specific thing is pretty long because he is landing and having to jump far on the next one. But it's not landing, thinking about it and jumping again either. He's rolling into another jump. Mm-hmm. So we do have some things that it's not a really bouncy thing, but but we're still trying to keep that amortization phase as little as possible. And you're exactly right. My slowest guys, they land and take forever to regather enough wherewithal to get another jump. So I would think the guy that can triple broad jump the furthest probably does it in the least amount of time too, if that makes sense.
It does make sense because there is no pause in what he's doing. His muscles can recoil. I mean, that goes back to maybe some Verhansky Russian plyometrics, you know, charging the hamstring, keeping the bounce.
Yep. And you know, I'm thinking that there are some things that we do that, you know, like when we do pogo jumps, like pretty much straight legged, bounce, bounce, bounce. It always in my mind, there's some African tribe. It's just like one tribe in the Sudan or something, where the men will do these jumps as a ritual to gain, you know, status for a woman. And they can jump like 3 feet up in the air with relative, it looks like their legs are totally straight. Well, let's just say that they would make a good 4x1 team for me. I've never seen them sprint, but if you can just bounce, 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 like 36 inches on every bounce, I can teach you to sprint fast too. And you probably already can sprint fast. So yeah, I think those things, you know, and that's what 42 years of coaching track has given me is the connections. Oh, and, you know, another thing you said that I thought was brilliant, you know, like a short jump into a long one. Those things are really, that's really advanced thought. Let's just say most people do in a weight room. They don't have those thoughts, which that's cool though. And one of the things that we do sometimes is we have these portable bleachers. They're like, maybe 30, 36 inches. Mm-hmm. And we'll step off and we'll do just a depth jump. You know, we'll bounce off the ground, jump over a hurdle. Good guys can jump over a college high hurdle. Mm-hmm. Bad guys can barely jump over a wicket. Once again, very strong correlation between the guys that can bounce and bounce high versus the guys that land with a thud and can barely get over a 6-inch hurdle. Big difference. But what you alluded to, which I like, this is advanced space. This is advanced stuff here, where you can step off and maybe you put like a wicket like 3 feet in front of you and a higher hurdle like 6 feet away from you. So you're doing like you're landing and you're jumping long and then high.
Right.
And those things are, you know, you studied some of the Russian guys, right?
A little bit, yes.
Okay. So yeah, I have not studied the Russian guys. I just act like I know what I'm talking about when people bring up, who'd you bring up?
Verhansky.
That's it. Yeah. So when somebody brings up Verhansky, I just kind of play along and, you know, hopefully I get the gist of what they're talking about.
Well, yeah. And so I guess I was asking so much about that as I recently read Bud Winter's Rocket Sprint Start, I believe is the name of it. And he was talking about 85% of your propulsion down the track is in a vertical movement, 15's in a horizontal. I don't know if you agree with that, but, you know, not knowing a whole lot about sprinting, that's just kind of the system we've went with.
Mostly it's vertical?
Yes.
And no, I wrote an article about 8 years ago that called vertical force is the holy grail, and so that's basically what we're talking about. There is at max speed sprinting.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yes,
you know, when you're tall and sprinting, you have two forces keeping you from being fast. Just two. One is friction, the air, and the other is gravity. And gravity dwarfs friction.
Right.
The gravity and the ability to stay stiff. A lot of people say stay strong because these sprinters, when they sprint at full speed, they have less than a 2-centimeter if you're like measuring their pupils, how much down they go or up they go, is about 2 centimeters. So their body remains stiff, and then you're in flight. Sprinters, elite sprinters spend 0.08 seconds on the ground. That's a 12th of a second. So if you took like 10 pictures of a sprinter, you may only get one picture out of those 10 where he has a foot on the ground, because he's in flight,
right,
at top speed. Now, it is also true that in the first 20 to 30 meters of a sprint, depending on how elite you are, your horizontal force will be much greater than your vertical force. So if you said like in an entire 100 meter dash that it was 85-15, I'm not sure. You know, I'm not sure, but I mean, I would kind of say that in the max speed phase, when you're going as fast as you can, it might be as much as 95.5.
Really?
That wouldn't surprise me. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have just tons of vertical force. I mean, you're just trying to stay in flight. And so, but when you're coming out, you have like a foot on the ground almost all the time.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Your body's like 45 degrees and we say be long and strong, long and strong. We're not cycling the legs. Our legs are more like pistons, and we're just hammering back. And you can't be like that for very long. You're after some kids, after 3 or 4 pushes, they're pretty much upright. And, you know, if you're an elite sprinter, you're going to get a lot more pushes in. So during that early part, it's almost flipped the other way around. It's much more horizontal than vertical force. And that's why, you know, people love to like push sleds, because you're working on those long, hard pushes, that horizontal force instead of the vertical force.
Okay. That makes sense to me. And then you also touched on something else I was wanting to ask about. The beginning part of the race, the acceleration phase, are you looking for your sprinters to carry that a little further before getting into top speed to stay away from the deacceleration part of the race? Do you feel like that carries over further to make them faster at the tail end of the race?
That's absolutely scientific thought, is that the longer we can hold acceleration, the less time we have to spend at top speed. And you've read enough, I guess, that for sure, everybody, no matter who you are decelerating some late in the 100 meters because you just can't hold that speed. Like nobody can hold that speed. It may look like somebody's speeding up in the last 10 meters, but really the other 7 guys are just slowing down. So yes, you know, you want to be big and strong and not rush acceleration. But that's about all I say. The last thing you want to do is say, I want you to accelerate for till the 30 meter mark and then get up and run.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to do that, because in acceleration, we want to come out not too low, because if you come out too low, you're going to stumble. You're going to come out probably around, you know, 60 degrees, 65 degrees if you're pretty strong. If you're weak physically, a lot of girls and stuff, you need to come out a little higher because you're just not strong enough to hold a low angle position. So when we come out, we want to gradually get tall, as gradually as possible. Like if we could come up like 1 inch per step and really hold that acceleration for a long time, gradually coming up, great. But if you tell somebody that they have to stay in acceleration, what they'll do is their bottom half of their body will be vertical and the top half will be down. And those angles are not good force angles. So when you're at top speed, you can't bend over and pretend to be accelerating. You know, it's just a gradual, you want to be straight. Your body needs to be pretty straight for force angles, but when you are done accelerating, you're done accelerating. You cannot pretend to hold it. Does that make sense?
And it's counterproductive to try to hold something that isn't working for you. That goes back to your minimalist thought, I guess. If it's not working, get rid of it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's, and you know, you can see it with kids. And if you video them, you can say, hey, look, I know you think you're still, you know, you're still in the acceleration phase here, but look how bent you are. Oh yeah, I'm pretty bent. All right. I said, yeah, if you're done accelerating, you got to just get tall and sprint.
And go for it.
Yeah, just go for it then. But there's no doubt that we still cue them long and strong, you know, like pound it behind you, gradually come upward, and then we're just going to get big and sprint.
That was a great way to explain it where I could understand it, and I'm not even a track guy. So if I can understand it, surely the track people out there will definitely understand.
But you have to, you know, I always say that, you know, like, you know, you can explain it to a kid, but they have to learn how to do it.
Right.
You know, you can say we're going to come out at 45 degrees, but the brain will oftentimes tell your foot to stop the stumble. So you have to actually, you know, like go up against a wall some, you know, mm-hmm. and get the brain used to that feeling and do some falling starts where you don't do the stumble reflex. You know, your shin angles have to stay correct, you know, or else you're not putting the ground behind you. You're just coming straight up. And as you've seen, the really bad accelerators, they may come out right on the first step. And then the second step is just horrible, way too far. And the only thing they can do is, you know, like try to stay bent, which is bad, or be straight up and down. They're not very fast yet. And they're not going to accelerate very well. But it's just a matter of, I guess my point is, you got to do it. You got to do it a lot. And we do.
Is that where your conditioning comes from? Because I know sprinting, you're only sprinting your guys a few sprints, a few days a week.
Yep.
Everything else is formed through, I'm supposing, drills and form, technique, mechanics.
Yeah. So one of the weird things about Feed the Cats is I say that Feed the Cats teams do not do conditioning.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It sounds crazy. You know, like a Feed the Cats football team does not do any conditioning. Now, people argue that everything is conditioning. You know, like when you're lifting weights, you're conditioning. You know, when you're sprinting, you're conditioning. I said, no. When I think of conditioning, I think of gassers. I think of that end of practice torture. That's what I, or anything that all you're trying to do is get real tired and get used to it. Lombardi said that fatigue makes cowards of us all. And we all agree with that. But what do you do about it? Well, for hundreds of years, for decades, what coaches have done is try to get people really, really tired as often as possible. And I'm like, that's, maybe there's another answer. Maybe tired is the enemy. If fatigue makes a coward out of me, let's don't practice tired. Let's practice bouncy. And people were like, no, wait a minute. That's like, that's right. It's revolutionary. So I like to call it capacity. We gain capacity by stacking together the work that we do. Even though it's only like 5 seconds of intensity. My guys yesterday, we were on break for like 21 days. We finally came back yesterday and we did a sprint workout. And I asked the guys, anybody sore from yesterday? And they all raised their hand. I said, you realize that even though we were here for 45 minutes, you only did 60 seconds of work. And they looked at each other like, how could we be sore when we only did 60 seconds of work? Well, it's really hard. It's not stuff that people, humans do. You know, we're doing stuff that's very extreme. But when we stack together things like that, there's a bizarre, magical, endurance-like effect that starts to happen. And I would argue that good athletes that are not conditioned in a traditional sense tend to play pretty good in the fourth quarter. They tend to, you know, fast guys tend to be the fast guys even when they're tired. I would argue that everybody's kind of tired in the fourth quarter. So we just don't do anything that conditions traditionally. And people say, well, how about the 400 meters in track? That's a hard race. Yes, it is. And we do, about 4 weeks before the first meet, we start doing lactate work, which we'll do some, you know, things like 3 200s with 3 minutes rest, spiked up and fast, timing, record ranking and publishing, things like that. And it's really hard on our guys. But we're not doing 10 of them. We're doing 3 of them. And I would argue that those 3 probably hurt worse than the 10 that I used to have to do. In the old fashioned, we're going to run 10 300s a day, 10 400s, 10 200s. So our guys get very specifically in shape to be fast in the 400. Now, the last 100 meters is hell. It is really, really hard. But what I tell them is this, that I could run them 20 miles of 200s every week, or 20 miles of 400s, or we could run 100 miles, and that last 100 would still be hard. So no matter how good a shape you're in, the last 100 meters is hard. Now, what that tells me is that if it's going to be hard no matter what, let's be fast. Let's be fast. And you know that if I ran my guys 100 miles a week, they'd be so far behind at the 300 mark that the last 100 wouldn't matter. And there's nothing worse than something being hard and you're in last place. You know, like you have a chance if you're leading or near the lead to come up with a great effort and win the race. And so when coaches say, well, we work really hard to make the 400 easy, I'm like, it's never easy. And if it is easy to you, you're not running fast enough. You jogged it. I guess it was easy because you jogged it. But you can't get beat by, you know, 120 meters in the 400 and say, man, I'm in such great shape. That was easy. No, you just ran slow. So that is a perfect metaphor to why football teams can go without conditioning in a feed-the-cat sprint-based model and still be really good in the fourth quarter. Because the fourth quarter is going to be hard for everybody. Not just the people who didn't do conditioning. It's going to be hard for everybody. And so I would rather be really athletic, fast, and explosive going into that fourth quarter and have it be hard than to be beat up, banged up, miserable. You hate your sport. But, man, you ran a lot of gassers going into that fourth quarter. And that's kind of why it works.
You said a few things in there that kind of line up with some other stuff I've read. Boyd Epley, the strength and conditioning coach at Nebraska when they were really good, mid-90s, late-90s. Him and Zach Duvall come to the same conclusion you did, that the volume accumulated in running was not helping their athletes perform any better in the fourth quarter than if they were rested. So, you know, why there have been some other outliers that understood what you were saying probably about the same time you did, maybe a little later, but yeah, people get this and it does work.
Well, you know, Boyd Epley, he's arguably the first guy that was ever a true strength and conditioning coach. The mm-hmm. first guy, like late 60s. I mean, Nebraska before him, their offensive tackles weighed like 215. And they couldn't bench 220. They couldn't bench 225. I mean, so he totally changed everything. And I troll Nebraska the previous several years under Scott Frost because they started doing things. I'm like, Boyd Epley knew what he was doing in the 80s, in the 70s and 80s and 90s. And he'd like preach against running laps. You don't run miles. Don't have a conditioning test that's a mile run. We need to repeat high intensity explosive efforts. And we're going to get conditioned that way. We're not going to get conditioned by the volume, as you said, of work. But yet Scott Frost before the Northwestern game actually bragged about the number of kids that threw up in the previous week. Their defensive line coach said, So my goal every day is to get my kids so tired in the first half of practice that they have to resort to the fundamentals we taught them in the second half. I'm like, no, don't do that. So it's weird that people knew what they were doing 50 years ago, and somehow people have lost their way now.
And the irony of that story is, if you read Boyd Epley's book, all the pictures of demonstrations are Scott Frost.
I did not know that. And, you know, I don't know. Sometimes, you know, I truly believe that, you know, that people are all delusional. We're all delusional. And we can believe stuff that's crazy. I mean, there's so many fingers to point out there. You know, people say, that guy is nuts. You know, he believes in stuff that's crazy, but he thinks he's right. And so, like, when people go down the wrong rabbit hole, you know, sometimes they just keep defending what's wrong. Mm-hmm. I think it's everywhere in sports, and has been for a long time.
Yeah, that leads to a question I had very early on, and then I kind of jumped around it and waited. Your program flies in the face of traditional ideas that have been held by coaches for years. How hard was it to get your system out there where people realized, hey, this might be a better way? How much adversity, I guess, did you have to face to get this system out there?
Yeah, that's a really cool question. I'm a big Bob Dylan fan, and he has a line that says, I'll know my song well before I start singing. Well, you know, from 1999 until like 2012, basically I just toiled in obscurity. I always loved when a young coach would email me and say, what do you do about this? I think I got a reputation for answering all emails. You know, and I love the whole mentorship thing and trying to help people out. But it wasn't until I started writing. I'd never written a thing in my life. You know, stupid things in college, you know, were 750 word thing or something. And you had to like pretend like you had more words than you really, you know what I'm saying? You know, it's like, how am I going to make this 750 words? And now, you know, I guess because I read so much and I had answered enough questions and emails and things that when I started writing, I knew my song pretty well. And so from 2012 to now, about 10 years, I think I've written like 300 articles. I've written a 400-page book twice now, and I have not published it yet. I think I'm going to start my third rewrite in early summer and put it out there. And so the reason why I was allowed to write is because nobody had to publish me, if that makes sense. You know, like you can publish yourself now.
Right. Exactly.
2012 was the time when I think I joined Twitter. And that was the time that, you know, you could write a blog and you didn't have to buy anything. And I was paid $100 to write one of those 300 articles. The other 299, I got nothing from it. You know, my wife's like, why are you doing this? And I'm like, because for forever, I had a lot to say and nobody wanted to hear it. So now I can write, and if people don't want to hear it, just don't read it. So when I started writing, the stuff got out there. And the number one most read article in the history of our track football consortium is New Ideas for Old School Football Coaches. And it's interesting. I wrote that in late July, right before double sessions or, you know, football was going to start. But it was the first year that I was not going to coach football. And being an assistant for all those years, I had a lot of stuff build up in me. You know, I'd seen a lot of crap. And so it was kind of like my manifesto. And it's been passed around now for, you know, 5 years, 6 years. And I mean, literally like 100,000 people have read it. And so that's how the ideas started getting out there. And I didn't think anybody would actually say, I'm going to start feeding the cats in football, or I'm going to start you know, the code word for Feed the Cats football is sprint-based football. You know, TCU's doing it. The Eagles are doing it. There's hundreds of high schools doing sprint-based football where sprinting is your priority. How fast guys are really matters. And we want to keep them fast all year. And we want to keep them fresh and have a foundation of recovery and sleep, and that performance is more important than hard work. So I really didn't think it would happen, but it started to happen. Brad Dixon, a coach at Camp Point Central in Illinois, it was an old school Neanderthal meathead. He'll tell you that. And he read that and was like, God, this makes too much sense not to do it. And so he did it at a school of like 265 kids. And they've won like 88% of their games. And Rick Arendt at Lena Winslow, another school of about 300 kids, he has a 92% winning percentage and has won 4 out of the last 5 state championships. And people say, well, that's little school. But then the big schools, some not everywhere, but some big schools started trying it just because it kind of made sense. And so that's how it got out there. And then we started that thing called the Track Football Consortium. Mm-hmm. Between me and Chris Corfist. Chris is, the smartest mad scientist I've ever known. He's the one that started RPR, Reflexive Performance Reset. And the two of us, you look back, we're running our 19th one in Sacramento, California, in February, 19 of them now. And we've had everybody from Stuart McMillan to Boo Schexnader to Matt Campbell, the coach at Iowa State, you name it, Michael Boyle. We've had some of the biggest names in sports in the entire world, in sports science and stuff. And so all that stuff kind of made everything kind of snowball. And then, of course, podcasts. I maybe have been on 100 podcasts now.
Really?
I just like to talk. I've just enjoyed talking with you for an hour, Stephen, And so people listen to a podcast. We're starved now for conversation. People don't talk enough.
And they're so careful about what they talk about.
That's true too. And I'm not, I'm kind of unfiltered,
And I've enjoyed that, be you, that's the way it's going
to
be the best.
Yeah, and I apologize to people every day, hey, I didn't mean, this. Say that about you, I love you, man. Everything's good. But because people don't get a chance to sit down on their front porch and drink iced tea and talk to another human, they listen to a podcast on the way to work. And so word gets out that way too. But I still think that, I know there's a lot of upcoming people, they're in their 20s and 30s that are wanting to be like an influencer or something. That's never been my goal. It just kind of happened. And I knew what to say, before I started saying it. And that helps. I'm not selling stuff I read about, and this is stuff that I do.
Yeah. You do it on a daily basis. You've seen it all, ins and outs. You definitely know it.
Made all the mistakes too. I've made so many mistakes. I could write a book on the mistakes I've made.
And those may have been the best teachers. That's what got you to where you are now.
Yep. When you wreck your car, you try not to wreck it again. So every wreck becomes a very important ignition point in your life. Those car wrecks, and I would have never had those car wrecks if somebody would not have trusted me with the keys to the car. And so, some of these people just haven't driven their car enough to really understand the ins and outs and understand how much there's left to learn.
Tons. Yeah, it never stops. I'm sure you research all the time to find a new way to be better.
I'm always talking to people, and it's kind of like when I'm talking about the consortium stuff. What the consortium has allowed me to do is to be around people that are smarter than me, where like everyone in the room is smarter than I am, and I feel inferior, but I ask good questions, and so But, you know, when I taught science, you know, kids all think that science is just coming up with the right answers on the test. So they just think you're supposed to learn the facts. And I'm like, no. Nobody's ever gotten excited about learning the facts. What excites sciencey people is to know that we don't know anything yet. You know, it's like 90% of everything there is to be known, we don't know yet. That's exciting. And that's where I am, you know, at the twilight of my coaching career, is that I know that what I did last year, I'm going to be doing some better things this year. I'm sure of it. And 5 years from now, I'll look back and say, man, I don't think I did a very good job 5 years ago.
Yeah, I can see that. It takes a lifetime to learn a lifetime, though.
It does. And it's all okay. It's okay. You know, there's a saying that if you're not a little bit embarrassed by your former self, then you haven't evolved enough, you know? And yeah, I mean, I wasn't a bad coach 5 years ago, but I'm a better coach now, you know, because I've learned some things.
Yeah. The evolution of a track coach, I guess.
You got it.
That is one you touched on it there earlier about how you like to talk and some different things like that. That was something I saw on your YouTube pages. It was just incredible. You took time to answer so many people's questions. You don't see that on YouTube. You don't see that the guy that made the video out there answering the questions the coaches are asking.
There's some really dumb questions too. I mean, like some people are like, they're awful. But no, I try to answer all those. I probably answer 5 to 10 emails a day. Sometimes it gets old, but I think people appreciate that. And all my YouTube, one of the good things about my YouTube thing is one of my four kids, Troy, runs my YouTube channel. So I don't have to worry about any of the content there. I just send it to him. And so then I answer it. I answer the questions and stuff. And then I'm on Insta and TikTok, and I actually let him answer all easy questions. But once in a while, somebody will, you know, ask a question that's kind of loaded or something, and he'll say, how should I answer this one? You know, so I'll send him the answer. But that makes us, the more we have to answer questions, the more we refine our message.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know? Yeah. I get to ask you a bunch of questions. I get to learn what I want to ask, how I want to ask it. Then you get to answer them. Hopefully I ask some questions you don't get every day.
For sure. You know, somebody asked Neil deGrasse Tyson, you know who that is, right?
Mm-hmm.
They say, how do you respond to questions so fluently? And he said, you know, pretty much every question I've ever been asked has either been asked before or I've written about it. And I thought, I think I have probably written about almost everything I've ever been asked. And if you ask me a question, amortization, right? Is that correct? What we're talking about?
Yeah.
Okay. So I didn't know what in the hell that was. But the next time somebody asks me about amortization, I'll be like, well, that's, you know, that's basically balance and blah, blah, blah. So, you know, we learn by doing what we're doing right now.
I know I've learned an incredible amount between the stuff you have out there now and then this conversation. I'm not a sprint guy. I want to see my kids be faster. You seem to be able to find it on a kid's level and make a kid faster. So who better to talk to? I mean,
well, you know, I wanted to address some what you just said. You know, like there's a lot of people say, well, you know, I really not a sprint scientist. You don't really have to be. I mean, if you did nothing but time kids with a stopwatch in the 40 three times, write down their time, and then do that three times a week, your kids may get faster. They probably will. And there are some really smart coaches out there that are planting beans to grow corn. In other words, they're doing everything but sprinting.
Mm-hmm.
And their kids might not get any faster. So I think one of the things about Feed the Cats is that people that have no background in sprint science or track can be empowered like, okay, you do these 10 speed drills and you try to get kids better at them. And then you time them 3 times. And then I was like, is that all you do? I said, that's, you can do a lot more, but that's a pretty good place to start. And I call it my atomic workout. And so yeah, people, and I think that's good because there's too many people that don't sprint because they don't think they're a sprint coach.
That makes sense. I can see that. They almost let the fear of not knowing keep them from even trying.
Yeah. It's like me, like I felt that way in the weight room when I had to take over a weight room in the mid-90s. But I learned the basics. You know, I read Bigger, Faster, Stronger. And, you know, and I went and watched some people lift, and we did the core lifts. And, you know, I knew enough that my kids got stronger. And we kept track of it. Record, rank, and publish is a big part of BFS. And now, did I know everything that Boyd Epley knew? Hell no. I knew 1%. But that did not keep me from being effective. You know, you don't have to have a PhD in the weight room to get your kids stronger. And that's just an important thing for all of us to remember, because I think a lot of us just fear that we're not good enough.
Well, and that's some of it. But now the internet's really taken away a lot of excuses. I mean, anything you want to know is on there, and not just by some backyard guy that says he can teach track. I mean, there's people like you on there that are willing to give up their time and information to make guys like me better. And I know I appreciate it.
Yeah. I look back. I did not have those options when I started in 1981.
Yeah. You were trying to find good quality books and try to talk to people across the phone, figure out who could help you. It's a way different ballgame back then.
The one thing that I did a lot of that I still really I urge coaches to do, and that is visit people that do things well. Visit them. I mean, I have people that say, hey, can I buy you breakfast? I'm like, sure. You know, I have to eat breakfast. You know, I'll spend a couple hours eating breakfast with you. Or, you know, just yesterday, a guy, I thought he was just from Wisconsin. Hell, he's the assistant S&C coach at the University of Wisconsin that came down to visit a speed workout. And, you know, I didn't realize that it was the University of Wisconsin until we were walking out. And I'm like, what? You were on the staff of Chris and Jim Leonard? He goes, yeah, I'm unemployed now because they went a new direction with the head coach. Right. And so I'm like, oh my God. But this guy from the University of Wisconsin visits, you know, a Plainfield North High School track coach and just wants to sit and talk, you know, and we learn so much from watching good people coach or good people do anything. And so I totally agree that what we can read and see on the internet and what we hear on podcasts, fantastic. But man, don't ever forget that you can visit people too.
Yeah. And that's something that we're losing in the newer generation. As I find, even with my kids, they're more scared to talk to people than what we were, because there was no other way when we were, I mean, you're a little older than me, but growing up, there was no other way to talk to somebody. You had to go to them and talk to them.
Yeah, that's why people don't date anymore. You know, guys don't know how to walk up to a girl and say, hey, how you doing? You know, people are, it's just weird that people don't talk as much. We're really busy, all those things. But man, you know, you don't even have to be an outgoing person to say, can I come observe a practice? I mean, I think I've spent over 100 hours in the basement of Chris Corfist. I just go sit and watch what he does with athletes. And I'm good at asking questions like, why are you doing that? And he will answer it. And I'll say, when did you start doing that? Or why did you start doing that? And it makes him think. And you know, 100 hours later, 200 hours later, he's like my best friend.
It works well. It works better than what people think it does, because everybody wants a chance to tell you what they know.
I think people, I tell people all the time that people are honored to be asked questions. Like honest to God, when I was a teacher, I would go through like entire months with nobody asking me about my track team or nobody asking me about speed training. So man, if I run into somebody that, you know, that wants to talk my business, I'm like honored to talk.
Well, I know I appreciate that. I mean, part of this podcasting thing is finding good guests and people that know their stuff. And for you to come on here and help me out and help whoever watches this out, that's incredible. And I'm very appreciative of that.
Yeah, it's been fun, man.
Well, I know I've kept you probably longer than what you wanted to, but I appreciate the time and I hope you have a wonderful evening.
Well, thank you, Stephen. If I can ever help you out, let me know.
All right. Well, thank you very much.